My guest today, peace activist, attorney, and writer Esperanne Wilson, served as a first lieutenant in Vietnam, where as commander of a U.S. Air Force Combat Security Police unit in the Mekong Delta in 1969, he was charged with documenting the aftermath of the bombing of five Vietnamese fishing villages. Transformed by the experience, he became a peace activist. On September 1, 1987, during a nonviolent blockade of trains headed to the Concord Naval Weapons Station, which supplied weapons for the Contras in Nicaragua, a train accelerated, striking Wilson and severing both of his legs. In the aftermath of the incident, thousands of peace activists descended on the scene, ripping the rails out of the ground and creating an encampment that lasted for 2.5 years and ultimately resulted in the closure of the Concord Naval Base. As Wilson observed in his book Blood on the Tracks, when the U.S. government offered a cash settlement to Wilson several years later, it was a de facto acknowledgement that the Navy train crew and their superiors intended not to stop the train. By not stopping, as Wilson observed, the Navy's civilian crew was in fact simply following orders. Esperanne Wilson is the subject of a new documentary that debuts in Portland on July 3rd at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. You can find information about the screening on the KABU website. Brian Wilson's Memorial Day reflection, remembering all of the deaths from all of our wars, appeared in Counterpunch on May 27th. In the second segment of this two-part interview, we spoke about the 1987 rail blockade and the obstruction of business as usual as a tactic in Occupy and in the contemporary struggle against oil, trains, and climate change.
There were examples of blockades before we started our blockade in 87, and I had done a lot of research on the history of train blockades. I mean, we knew we had the Rocky Flats blockade in Colorado, the plutonium center there. And there were blockades of those trains, and we knew about the white train blockades out of Bangor.
In Washington.
And there were others. I had identified labor strikes where the railroad workers blocked trains. I also identified cases in the 60s with students blockading troop trains. So I had, and the trains always stopped. See, so I had done this research. So when we started our blockade in Concord, it was in 87, and we had cased out the base for several weeks to know what the modus operandi was, what the protocol was, and so forth, the speed limit, 5 miles an hour, the fine for blocking, $5,000 fine, a year in prison, didn't say anything about, you know, being killed or, you know, death penalty or anything. So I did not expect, of course, to be run over. That wasn't the protocol. It was in violation of their own regs. they weren't to run over anything, a car, a cow. But what happened when they did, actually 4 days later, there were 10,000 people that came and ripped up the tracks, about 100 feet of tracks, and made a statue of the railroad ties. But most significantly, because I was hit, it led to 24-hour occupation of that site, day and night, for 30 months. And every train was blocked for 30 months. 2,100 arrests. Now, the blockade continued for another 10 years after the 30 months. But it wasn't always 24 hours a day. But many of the trains continued to be blocked until about 1998. And this, I was run over in 1987. It forced the ultimate closure of the base. And plans, they had plans to build a bridge over the public highway, which bisected the base where we were demonstrating. That, and they never did that. But they were discussing it. How were we going to deal with this tenacious occupation? I mean, there were tents and a kitchen that was set up to continue feeding this occupation. But that energy came from the rage of the train running over me, and also two other vets that were impacted, but they didn't get run over. One jumped out of the way, and one jumped up and grabbed the cowcatcher railing and jumped off the train. It was the first person in my body. But see, I think this kind of obstruction about business as usual is really, really important. And you do, if you are going to be tenacious about it, you have to take the risks. And there may be severe risks involved the more tenacious it gets, because if the system couldn't tolerate Occupy, they were terrified at Occupy. So powerful, because it was people power. Every town saw this people power. Obstruction of business as usual, obstruction of the war economy, obstruction of war in various ways is critical in my mind, and that includes tax refusal.
And do you see the rail blockades of oil trains as part of the disruption of the war economy?
Absolutely.
Specifically?
Yeah, absolutely. Natural gas pipelines, oil trains, coal trains, and nuclear trains, if they still are moving. I think they stopped moving them by train and moved them by truck now. But anything that disrupts business as usual with nonviolence, so you're not giving them any excuse to be violent. That's really important. Nonviolence is, first of all, way more powerful than violence, because it establishes a new way of operating without harming others, including without harming the adversary. It also is much more difficult for the system to deal with, because if the dissenters are using violence, it's real easy to justify using violence against them. If they're not using violence and are very conscious and very intentional to be militant without the violence. Militant means tenacious. And I think nonviolence is way more powerful than violence. Nonviolence against violence is very hard for the authorities to deal with, because it raises grave moral issues about the imbalance of forces. You are acting, you are thinking, you are feeling, you are speaking as if all life was sacred, knowing that other people don't necessarily agree with that. But you are establishing that as a model, as an example, with your own life, with your own protest. To me, it doesn't matter whether we quote-unquote win or lose, as it's measured in modern terminology. It's really important to dissent and protest in a way that glows with dignity and authenticity of honoring the sacred in everything. That's one reason we're obstructing the oil trains, because we believe in the sacredness of life. And these oil trains are part of a chain of policies that are destroying life. And we're opposed to that, obviously. And so, to me, nonviolence... I mean, I've had to practice and read and rehearse nonviolence, because it's not how I was conditioned. But the way I was conditioned, I know, is really, really destructive. The film starts out... The Paying the Price for Peace starts out with a speech I gave it, that I'm giving it, I think, at SOA down in Georgia, saying,
to be
a nonviolent revolutionary, you have to risk the consequences, including jail or death. I think that's the very first words in the film. You know, we're facing, by not being part of Rising Tide or Occupy or obstruction, we are participating in our own suicide. We're participating in the destruction of the planet. Industrial capitalism is on a collision course with life on the planet. Why would we want to continue facilitating it? It's not in our interest. You know, when Martin Luther King proposed Resurrection City and the Poor People's Campaign, he proposed that in a speech in November of 1967. It was going to start in May of 1968 on the Mall in Washington. He wanted 500,000 people camped on the Mall until funding for the Vietnam War was diverted to domestic needs. Now, he was assassinated on April 4th, 1968, because of that plan.
Oh, here to the date of the Riverside Church
right.
speech.
And that was considered such a serious threat to business as usual. So that didn't happen. They only had about, I was in D.C. at the time, and I was deputized. I was in the military, and they wanted military people to be ready to go down there. And it was a very rainy spring, and the mud was like 8 inches deep, and there were only like 3,000 people that came, not 500,000. And King was no longer around to be the spiritual leader. But it has reminded me that if we get to the point where we may be at that point in history now where it's ripe, and it's certainly ripe now with global warming and with U.S. militarism going crazy everywhere, that we really obstruct business as usual. And it requires numbers. And what brought the Concord base down was the absolute tenacity of a 24-hour occupation. I mean 24 hours a day. People were eating there. They were sleeping there. And other people were coming and bringing them food. They set up a kitchen there just off the base. So they were bringing food to these people every day. And even 10 years later when it was no longer, after the 30 months when it wasn't 24 hours a day, it was still daily. And it was wearing down the system. It was wearing down the police. It was wearing down the Marines. And I've received a couple emails recently from former soldiers that were guarding there, and they said, we were all told how terrible this guy Wilson was, but now we know you were a hero. You were right. And the base now is completely closed down, and it's owned by the city of Concord. It's going to be housing developments and a park, and but it took a lot. It took a lot of tenacious activities, but the trigger was likely the fact that I was run over. It was so grotesque. So
it really threw the violence of the state into relief.
And I was just sitting on the tracks. I wasn't even it's like the Israelis against the Palestinians, you know. You have this big train, I guess. Somebody just sitting there, three of us, three human beings, really vulnerable, fragile human beings, sitting in front of a 200,000-pound locomotive carrying highly explosive weapons. And in a way, you have to say that was a good thing to be doing, despite what happened to me. It was very thought out. It was very intentional. It's very conscious. It had a very comprehensive understanding of why we were there. To uphold the Nuremberg principles, it says when you know your government is committing a crime, is committing a crime against humanity, or is a crime against peace, which is intervening in another country, and you know about it, you have a duty to interfere.
You've been listening to a pre-recorded interview with S. Brian Wilson, who's the author of the book Blood on the Tracks and the subject of a new documentary called Paying the Price for Peace, which debuts in Portland on July 3rd at the Clinton Street Theater at 7 p.m. More information about how to purchase tickets can be found on the KABU website. This has been Desiree Helgers for the Old Mall Variety Hour.